Welcome to ASAP Nowcast, highlighting the very best content from this month's issue of ASAP Now, the magazine of the American College of Emergency Physicians and the official voice of emergency medicine. I'm your host, ASAP Now Medical Editor-in-Chief, Jeremy Faust. All right, everybody, it's July, so let's hop into it. I thought we would do a couple of nice articles about the neurologic assessment that we do in the ED. And let's be honest, sometimes emergency physicians have a little bit of a bad rap, for having done a subpar neurologic assessment before we call a stroke code or a neurology consultation. And it's always good to have done something. But I actually learned a lot in these two articles from EM cases, Anton Hellman, and then Jonathan Strong did one on diplopia. And let's start with the EM cases, the six-step approach to acute motor weakness, how to narrow your differential diagnosis. And I love this because it really does boil down to a lot of things that we do, but we don't necessarily always name it. And sometimes the most important thing is to name it correctly. So step one, does the complaint, the patient, do they complain of weakness, or is it really a true loss of motor power? And I think that we hear the word weakness, and sometimes it's like dizziness. It's what does that mean? What does weakness mean? And a lot of times what we want to do is really delineate with our patients whether it means something like being unable to pick up a cup of coffee or if they've had trouble standing up from a seated position. So those are very different problems. And so sometimes the thing you could do is to use the word power with patients. So you can say, do you have a loss of power with one of your arms? Do you feel like you can't lift something? As opposed to something a little more vague. The next step too is to understand the pattern of motor power loss. Not this diffuse weakness, it'll feel good, but really a specific pattern of motor loss. And that can correlate with specific neuroanatomy. This is distinctly different than the things like hypokalemia, hyperkalemia, thyrotoxicosis, and things like polymyositis and dermatomyositis. These are things where things are gonna be diffuse. But when you actually really have a specific pattern, you're looking at a different kind of condition. Think about things like an ascending pattern. So you're worried about Guillain-Barré. Think about a bilateral descending pattern, which really suggests a neuromuscular junction problem like myasthenia gravis or a Lambert-Eaton syndrome. I think that makes sense. So the pattern of motor loss, is it one-sided? Is it going up? Is it going down? Is it diffuse? Is it specific? The next thing we can get to is step three, the timing, the course, and the fatigability of the power loss. So obviously, timing is a huge thing in our field. So if there's an abrupt onset, obviously we're all thinking about a vascular event, we're thinking about a stroke, and we do everything we do in our sort of code strokes or our stroke protocols to get things moving for our patients. But occasionally you can have kind of a stuttering worsening over several days, 100% there. But you also want to think about the opposite, which is this sort of slow onset, little by little. And in those kinds of situations, you could be thinking about metabolic abnormalities. Of course, I'm sure you've all seen an array of weaknesses relating to glucose levels and sodium levels. So these are problems that can happen on a more slow basis. Peripheral neuropathies, neuromuscular junction disease, myopathies, those kinds of things, those are going to happen over hours and days, not suddenly. Now, fluctuating or relapsing course suggests things that are a little more nameable, myasthenia gravis, multiple sclerosis, and we do think of the periodic paralysis, especially with thyroid disease. But sometimes things that come and go can be something like a peripheral nerve entrapment, can be positional, and of course, there's always, if you ask me, the complex migraine can look like a stroke, can look like anything, but really goes away once you've treated the pain. Of course, we don't use pain treatment as a diagnostic tool because we follow our ASAP guidelines, but I think we all know that if you have a patient with a history of complex migraines, hemiplegic migraines, for example, you want to make sure you can tease that out before you over-treat, over-test, and get yourself into the wrong protocol. Finally, fatigability or worsening motor weakness with repeated use, chewing, talking, that really is the classic on your board exam and in life for myasthenia gravis. All right, step four, thinking about associated findings. And there are five key associated findings that can accompany motor power loss that can really help you localize and narrow down the lesion that you're looking for: an absence of reflexes, looking at bladder dysfunction, looking for bulbar symptoms like diplopia, dysarthria, dysphagia — that would be a brainstem lesion — and to think about which side of the brain, left versus right. You can think about issues there. For example, if you have dysphagia, sometimes that's more associated with a left-sided cortex lesion. And of course, you're going to look for things like hemispatial neglect and all kinds of fancy tests that are described in this article that I won't go into here. But suffice to say that once you're down this path, you're beyond 95% of EPs at this point. But I'll leave a little bit of reading for you to do in the magazine. And then one thing that I think we all should be doing, and I think we do this, is step five, which is to distinguish between upper and lower motor neuron weakness. And that can be done quite simply. The Babinski reflex, increases in reflex, those are going to be your classic upper motor neuron lesions. I feel like I'm a board exam review course right now. The Babinski, the increase in reflexes, upper motor neuron. Yes, it does ring a bell, I think. And decreased or absent reflexes, that would be associated with the lower motor neuron lesions. And sometimes you can get into the weeds here. The speed of things can make a difference. And again, I'll refer you to the article, but again, upper versus lower, that's really the key. You're going to have those increased reflexes with the upper, decrease with the lower, and I think that's enough for here. The next and final step is to differentiate the types of lower motor neuron lesions, if you think that you've got a lower motor neuron lesion, of course. And in that case, you're going to be thinking about things like, is it painful? Myopathies are painful, so proximal muscles are being affected. You might be thinking about sensory deficits, right? With long nerves obviously getting affected first, which you do see in Guillain-Barré. I don't think we miss a lot of Guillain-Barré just because it's something that's on our mind a lot for some reason, but do keep in mind that you can get a little more into the weeds and possibly a correct differential and a correct admission if you're thinking about things like that myopathy, that proximal muscle involvement, the pain. That's going to lead to a different set of neurological assessments in the inpatient environment, most likely, than you would have otherwise thought of. Lastly, you've got a nice four-step quick motor exam. I'll just mention a couple of them real quickly. The two that I think are interesting is the forearm roll test. And this is the test where you almost imagine, like in football, the false start motion, that the patient makes fists with both hands, they roll their forearms around each other for 10 seconds in both directions. And with an upper motor neuron lesion, the affected arm will be noticeably slower than the unaffected arm. I did not know that. So I love it. So editing this magazine, I always learn. So that was a good one. And the other one is something that I think we do, I didn't realize the name. I thought it's worth mentioning. But the lower extremity drift test, which is the Mingazzini maneuver. And the Mingazzini maneuver is, you got to picture it, the supine patient, so they're on their back, flexes hips so that their thighs are at right angles to the trunk. Okay? That's easy. And the lower leg is flexed, so it's horizontal to the stretcher. So that's your positioning, and they're supposed to hold that in place. And the affected thigh will slowly lower towards the bed, and the leg will lower in the patient with an upper motor neuron lesion. And that's the Mingazzini maneuver. And I couldn't help it. I always like to look it up when something's named after a doctor who's no longer alive. It's like, were they a good person in history? Were they a bad person in history? It's always a little awkward. They're on the wrong side of history. They were like not with the Allies in various wars. In this case, Mingazzini was actually an Italian doctor who specifically denounced Mussolini. So I thought that was kind of cool. Good for him. All right. So that is not quite the entirety of the EM case's six-step approach to acute motor weakness, but definitely a lot of it. And I didn't go into a couple of the tests just because I thought it was too much, but definitely check it out in the magazine. And that was really part one of our little two-part neuro special. The second part is an article that I was really excited to have submitted by my colleague here at my hospital, Jonathan Strong. And this is an overview of diplopia, or double vision. And wow, this is a tough one. The etiologies are vast. You've got life-threatening causes like strokes and aneurysms, and then you have less urgent, more chronic causes, things like misalignment of the eyes, even slowly evolving microvascular disease, which
is stigmata of other processes, for example, peripheral artery disease and that sort of thing. But we always want to think about life and organ threatening causes. And with diplopia, there are a few we've got to think about. One thing I just love about this article is that it just gave me a really good chance to review the neuroanatomy of the eye. And we've got a great figure in the magazine that really shows which nerves, 3, 4, 6 in particular, and what they do in terms of introduction, superduction, adduction. And it's a great image we've got there just to review your board exams if you're certifying or recertifying. But I think the really big line in the sand, as Jonathan Strong points out in this article, is really whether this patient who has double vision, this patient in front of you, has diplopia with additional neurologic deficits or not. And if they really do have additional neurologic deficits, that is highly suggestive of a posterior circulation stroke. Patients presenting with acute onset diplopia in combination with altered mental status, bulbar weakness, and by that I mean difficulty with speech and swallow, facial muscle use, emotional volatility, vertigo, or cross brainstem signs, i.e. that's ipsilateral cranial nerve deficits with contralateral limb weakness or sensory loss, that's the cross brainstem signs. Those folks ought to be considered as having a brainstem stroke until proven otherwise, and you probably have an institutional stroke protocol for that, and now's the time to engage in that. But after you've really excluded that, or if you don't have that, we're talking about diplopia without additional neurologic deficits that would suggest a stroke, you do want to start to think about some more ophthalmologic issues, and it would be important to figure out the orientation of the situation. Is it horizontal? Is it vertical? Is it oblique? Does the diplopia worsen in a particular direction? This will help you identify if particular extraocular muscles are affected, and if so, maybe you've got a lesion as well that's going to be compressing or causing a problem there. And also, as anything, onset and timing can aid you. Intermittent diplopia that worsens with fatigue later part of the day, myasthenia gravis. That is the theme of the day. Things that later in the day, it's like myasthenia gravis, right? Slower progressive diplopia may suggest compressive causes. As I mentioned before, you can figure out maybe based on where in the extraocular movements things are slowing down or weakening. And intermittent diplopia can be due either to, again, myasthenia or a decompensating phoria or misalignment of the eyes. That's obviously a major cause of diplopia. This article ends with a nice rundown of the various localizations that you might discover depending on your examination, and importantly, the suggested imaging workup, because this is key, right? Whether or not you're worried about an isolated cranial nerve third palsy, which might or might not require MR or CT angiography. There are some correlates here that you're not going to remember, but it's really key. It's a great resource. Check it out, because one of the questions I always run across is, okay, I've done a good exam. I know at least I can describe what I'm looking at, but what next? And this is a nice resource because it gives you a really nice idea of which imaging to get and therefore how to get your diagnosis really nailed down. All right, let's slow down from clinical for just a second and let's cover just a little discussion about our medical legal mind column, which is always going back and forth between Dr. Gita Pensa and Dr. Eric Funk. Dr. Funk doing high-level M&Ms. These are like med mal cases that went bad. And Dr. Pensa doing a lot of work on how to think about if you are being sued or are involved in any legal proceedings. And in this case, Dr. Pensa is writing about what happens when you, the physician, are on trial and how to put your best foot forward. This was part two of a two-part series. And in the first part of the series, Dr. Pensa talked about, you know, the sequence of events at trial and what might happen. But this is really about how to be on the stand, how to not get rattled by the defendant, the opposing lawyer, and optics, and things like, what should you wear, which is not too flashy, and should you make eye contact with a jury? Yes, sometimes. And should you practice ahead of time? Yes, definitely. It's interesting, like any other skill, whether it's like suturing or intubating or what have you, being on the stand and talking about medicine is its own kind of performance art, And I think that Dr. Pence has got a really good point here, which is that deliberate is indicated. Just like any other thing we do as emergency physicians, these things take practice to get good at them, and they should be thought of as skills, just like any other skill, as part of our job. And if you practice enough, then you can rely on a good technique. Again, that same kind of analogy. If you've got good technique intubating, then when a tough intubation happens, you are ready. And if you've got good technique on the stand and know how to talk about your case and know what's in your chart and you've rehearsed, then you will be less likely to make a mistake when it really matters. So check that out. That's the Medical Legal Mind section in the magazine. Also, a lot going on politically lately with the ASAP workforce report. Lots of controversy there. Definitely something that we're not going to be able to dive into now, but ASAP has definitely summarized what's going on, what they're going to do, and how are we going to have 4-year residencies, 3-year residencies? Are we going to have more fellowships? What about balancing things with PAs and NPs, and how do we handle that tension? That's all in ASAP for you. In addition, we have a nice announcement from our new resident fellow, Dr. Cara Borelli. She's our first resident fellow. She'll be serving for a year, and she's a resident physician, and she'll be handling the resident voice column. And so she's got an introduction there that we've got in the magazine. So welcome, Dr. Borelli, to the ASAP Now team. Excited to have the first ASAP Now resident fellow, because Annals has one. We had to have one ASAP Now, I thought, and I think it'll be great to keep the resident voice column fresh. The resident voice column, by the way, is near and dear to my heart, because the resident voice column back when ASAP Now was ASAP News, which people still call it that. People are like, oh yeah, you're the editor of ASAP News, and I'm like, yeah, I guess you could say that, but it's called ASAP Now. Has been since 2014, since Kevin Clower took over and then handed it off to me. But anyway, we have never had a resident fellow before, and so now we do, and I think it's a really good thing. The resident voice column, as I was saying, was a column that was back in ASAP News. I used to write for it, and in fact, I took it over the year that I was an intern, and then moved on after that, after Dr. Clower took over, and I did other things. So now the resident voice column has been revived, but a little slow under my editorship, and I'm hoping that the resident fellow, I know the resident fellow, will make sure that this column space is revived, is lively. And that means residents, if you're listening, or attendings who teach in residency programs, tell your residents to get in on this and submit things to the magazine for the resident voice column that you think would be interesting. And what topics? Honestly, whatever is really relevant to residents. I always like to say, write from your lane, from something that you can be experienced about. No one is going to expect a resident to say, oh, I'm going to write a piece about what it's like to be a physician for 30 years. No, you want to write about what it's like to do XYZ as a resident. So that's the resident voice column. I really hope to see it thrive in the future, and excited that it will for sure. So welcome, Dr. Borelli, and watch that space. Quick rundown of what else is in the magazine this month, just so you know what to leaf through when it shows up in your inbox, in your mail, or in your snail mailbox. We've got a Q&A with John Perichol, who was the recipient of a recent EMF grant to study COVID-19 social determinants of health over where he is in North Carolina. Really valuable project there, and I do enjoy reading about the EMF grantees, because honestly, this is money very well spent, so be following that as well. The forensics column has a pretty interesting dive on lacerations and avulsions, and again, there's some nomenclature here that I gotta tell you, I was not aware of, so that's a teaser. You think you know about lacerations, I thought I did too, but honestly, there's some stuff here that I did not know, and could really make my documentation much better, especially if you're thinking about forensics, the idea of documentation that might be involved in any legal proceedings. So it's good to be very specific, and whenever you can, take photographs and work them into your secure charts. That's, to me, the major take home as well. Additionally, we have our residency spotlight. We have a great Skeptic's Guide to Emergency Medicine with my friend, the Canadian legend, Ken Milne, talking about using steroids in cardiac arrest, or maybe not using steroids in cardiac arrest, because really we don't have great evidence on that. Check that out. And we have a recurring column as well called Special Ops. And this has been around for a while in ASAP Now. And it's really cool because you get to read about how hospitals around the country have dealt with a problem. What's a problem that hospitals have encountered or emergency departments, and what's an innovative way that they have dealt with it? And in this case, boarding being looked at in terms of understanding discharge delays. So a lot of this is really about hospitals understanding that boarding is not a problem that is created by emergency departments, but it's one that we are certainly on the receiving end of it because we have patients who can't move. We can't get them up to their beds. And what this article by Sherry Welch does is really nails down what a lot of hospitals on the inpatient side are doing to deal with discharge delays, which can then help us reduce boarding times. And again, we're not going to do this implementation in the EDs, but I think that her point is that if we know about what hospitals are doing, then we can suggest that our hospitals take a look at this kind of approach. How do they do discharge delay minimization? And maybe that can trickle out to hospitals like yours and mine. So that's the point there. We've got a great by the numbers. Unfortunately, bad news, a lot of more cardiac arrests outside of the hospital during the COVID pandemic due to opioids, likely in part due to decreased ability to get things like methadone and buprenorphine. So that's the data snapshot. And I will say, last but not least, we've got a little farewell from me. This is my last time editing the magazine. So I wrote a little bit about my experience writing for this magazine for 9 years and editing it over that period of time. Writing for 7 and editing for 2. It's been a real joy and privilege. And also sharing my excitement about my successor, Dr. Cedric Dark, who is a colleague and a real friend. And I'm excited to see what Dr. Dark, Cedric, does with the magazine. I think that we've done some really great work here in terms of diversifying the voices that show up in the pages to reflect just the entire spectrum of our field, right? This is a very dynamic college, and I wanted to make sure that those voices were heard. I wanted young voices, middle career, late career, diversity, any way you slice it, whether it's racial and ethnic or gender or whatever it would be. I just wanted to make sure that as diverse as the college is, that our pages reflect that. And I think we've done that. I'm really proud of that work, and I think that's going to increase in the future. And on top of it, I think that we've always stuck to the good clinical content. We've stuck to really trying to highlight the advocacy work that you do, that people at the college, the staffers, the full-time pros do. I think the magazine works because this college is doing good work. So obviously there are places where we struggle and there are places where we need to improve. But I think that the magazine is a place where we keep up with that and we learn about what's going on and it inspires people to get involved. And that is the whole point. So I would just like to say it's been a real honor and a privilege for me to do this for the past couple of years and to write for longer than that. And I look forward to being involved in other ways. I'll be around. I don't think you'll have trouble finding me. I have a way of being outspoken and opinionated on everything that matters when it comes to emergency medicine and medicine in general. Yeah, I'm excited for the future and grateful for the opportunity and happy to pass off the baton to Dr. Dark. So take care, everyone, and see you around.
ASAP Now is published by Wiley and is a product of the American College of Emergency Physicians. The views expressed on ASAP Nowcast are those of the host and any guests. Our music is provided by Caroline Shaw and So Percussion. Thanks for listening.